The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly. It's been a big weekend. Now we go again with an even bigger midweek. Today we discuss how Sunderland held Chelsea, ask what's less likely to get sent off, Diego Costa or the FA's Christmas card to Blatter, look at Saints and the City with Pellegrini's men moving to just the 6 points off the lead, and celebrate the return of the men who score less than Pounders, Soldado, Johnson, Smalling, Clichy, Welbeck and Joe Cole. Abroad, Maldini's boys no longer teeny, Turin derby madness, Dortmund a Klopp-a-lipse now as fans turn on their manager, Sid on a deadly weekend in Spain, and David Moyes asking which one's Stefano, all of that and more in this Football Weekly. All right, well, that sounds quite a lot to get through, eh? Luckily, we've got top people on it today. John Ashdown.
Hello there.
Right. Paul McInnes.
Good day to you.
Yes. And Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Barry Glendinning in a suit.
Yeah.
Hey, you're looking very smooth there, Barry.
I'm all whistled up.
All right. Why?
Football Supporters Federation Awards tonight.
The FSF Awards.
Yeah, you're presenting them, Jimbo, just in case you've forgotten.
No, who will I be handing out those special baubles to?
I don't know.
I bet you do, though, don't you? You know one of the awards.
I do, yeah.
How come you know one of the awards?
I'm in the know. I know one of the winners.
You're ITK.
Right. I'm sorry?
He's ITK.
Oh, right. How ironic that I wouldn't know that's what that means. Anyway, now, hey, a lot to get through, as I say, because one round's just happened, there's another one about to happen, and pow, let's start off with Sunday afternoon's thriller at St Mary's, Southampton with a 3-0 defeat at the hands of Man City. First off, well, what do you want to start with? Do you want to start with Southampton, has their bubble burst? Has Man City bubble kind of unburst, blown up?
I think it's premature to say that Southampton's bubble has burst. Mm. They were well beaten. They seemed a bit cowed at the start, despite playing at home. They were very tentative in the first 20 minutes and then kind of got into the game. But they've now lost 3 out of 3 against teams that finished in the top six last season. They've had a splendid start to the season and they're doing very, very well. I think a lot of people were possibly hoping that they would show their mettle and show how far they've come by beating City, but ultimately they were well beaten, conceded 2 goals against 10 men. But when City are playing as well as they did, I don't think there's any shame at all in losing to them. City were mightily impressive.
Some people have been commenting that Southampton could have had more from this game, but to be fair, so could Man City. Could easily have had 4 goals had Mike Jones not come up with that bizarre decision.
Yeah, that was patently a penalty. Particularly since the defender kind of copped up to it and sort of pointing outside the box, it was a foul, but it wasn't a penalty.
Any chance that will be revisited?
I would have thought he might have that. There's a prospect for that yellow card being rescinded.
What would that do?
I don't think yellow cards
points
can be rescinded unless it's a case of mistaken identity.
Ah.
Wow. Fact. Well, let's pretend I never said that. But I thought that the game was actually pretty closely matched until City went to 10 men, and then kind of Saints had a touch of the Arsenals, lost their shape, pushed too many players forward, something Koeman acknowledged and the mistakes they made. And they were punished for it with some excellent finishing, and you know, Aguero got the taste of blood at that point, and he made the difference. But I think really it was very close. Saints were very well organised. They actually had the better of the first half. I wasn't entirely sure watching the game where City were going to get their goal from until they did. But the quality that they had, particularly in their attacking 3 or 4, you could see that there was superior quality there than what Saints had, and that will be the difference between Saints and the top four sides.
Frank Lampard.
Well, exactly.
Wow. Saints will be travelling to the Emirates, not the Emirates yet, but the Emirates, the stadium, to take on Arsenal on Wednesday, Barry. We'll talk more about that later on. City, meantime, Man City are at Sunderland, who've only just gone and held Chelsea. What a remarkable result, Barry. Who could have foreseen that? Who could have foreseen that?
You?
I don't like to mention it. But
I certainly couldn't. No. I mean, I was chatting to a Chelsea fan before the game and said to him that if I was offered a 4-0 defeat, I'd take it.
Really?
I was really worried. I thought they'd get thrashed. And I'm so proud of a brilliant performance by Sunderland. Every single player played well. Mm. Lee Cattermole was absolutely immense. But it feels a bit unfair to single him out. I mean, even José Altidore had played well when he came on, and I've never have anything good to say about him apart from the fact that he's a nice guy. Mm. But he was really good, and Gus Poyet had a plan, and the players stuck to it rigidly, and it worked, and they could have won it.
What was the Poyet blueprint then?
Just everyone working hard. It was quite a defensive lineup, 1-10 formation more or less, and yeah, the players just stuck rigidly to sort of lined out across the edge of their own penalty area and absorbed everything Chelsea threw at them. Mm. Had a little bit of luck, could have won the game in the end themselves.
Chelsea arguably rather lucky to finish the game with 11 players.
Because of Diego Costa.
Because of Diego Costa. It's not the first time he's been up to that and got away with it, is it?
No, he does have flailing arms, doesn't he? Mm. He tends to...
Also that challenge before.
Well, I think he should have had two straight reds. Mm. I don't think any Chelsea fans could really disagree. He lashed out at...
swung a foot, yeah. And John
O'Shea's face, didn't make contact. And John O'Shea, you know, isn't the kind of player who's going to sort of theatrically pretend he got hit when he didn't. And then, yeah, the elbow in the face of Wes Brown, I think that's a straight red as well. It could be argued it was a yellow, but when Diego Costa is that kind of player, if you know what I mean, he's constantly sort of kicking and elbowing.
And that's why people love him, isn't it? Because he's a traditional number nine. He's old-fashioned fighter scrapper.
He's got a nasty streak.
Can I ask about, just quickly, before, like, Sunderland's next opponents and Frank Lampard... being the ex-Chelsea player, it looks increasingly likely that he might stay on for City after his loan expires. Mm. Is that the case? Because I'm reading Jamie Redknapp today, who obviously has a close connection with Frank Lampard, and he's saying that he thinks he don't be surprised if he stays on because he will get no greater excitement than winning the title for City.
Because, so all the way to May.
Because Frank is a born winner. And I was
he should be going to...
New York City,
who are owned by Man City. So, yeah. But what I'd understood was that it's crucial for New York City and for their sponsors that they seem to be fielding a full-strength lineup when their season begins. I'm not sure if that's true or not. So, yeah... money might dictate otherwise. I don't know. Well,
but the sporting directors of the two clubs are the same. I'm reading from Redknapp that basically Lampard would want to continue playing in the Premier League. But that surprises me because he's just such a Chelsea guy that he would actually want desperately to win the title for City.
Well, Lampard himself was very coy when asked about this. And I would be surprised if he doesn't end the season with City. Mm. Manchester City.
But how can you, when you are the living embodiment of Chelsea?
He was once a West Ham boy.
Yeah, but I mean, 11 years, what does loyalty count for nothing anymore?
Well, perhaps he's a bit miffed that Chelsea didn't make more of an effort to keep him and would like to give them the flick the V's from afar.
Mourinho's saying, back to the Sunderland game, he said, Sunderland defended well, and this is not a crime. Magnanimous stuff there from Mourinho. Should he maybe have not gone with the same lineup for the third straight game? Were they a bit knackered, do you think, Chelsea?
I don't know. I don't know if that played too much of a role. I just thought, you know, if you build, have your backs to the wall as Sunderland did for most of the game, but you make sure that wall is 25 yards away from goal, then, you know, it's a difficult thing to get through. And tactically, I think Poyet got it spot on. I don't know if it really made much difference. I don't think Chelsea looked leggy at any point, really.
All right. Okay. Can Sunderland, will that wall built 25 yards from goal, will that work against Man City and the incredible Sergio Aguero and co?
They'll try it again, I would think. But yeah, I mean, can you do it? It's a tiring thing to do. Speaking of, you know, Chelsea not being tired, but I mean, I think psychologically it's a difficult thing. It's psychologically exhausting to kind of go there again. Right. So, you know, if they get to an hour or something, then who knows? But
who knows? Barry, you were citing historical precedents.
Yeah, well, Manchester City just can't win at the Stadium of Light. I think they've lost 1-0 there four seasons in a row. Definitely three. I think it's four seasons in a row. Which is seems remarkable, really. And perhaps that will play on their minds.
I'm sure it will. They seem quite susceptible to that kind of thing. Very much a mood team.
But, I mean, they were so impressive against Southampton that... and I do concur with Ashes there. I think Sunderland may be leggy and mentally exhausted after their heroics on Saturday.
And the mood thing goes both ways, doesn't it? Once they're in the mood, then you know they tend to go on these little runs where they you know they clock up a lot of wins. And
I'd say City fans would be relieved as well that although Aguero played brilliantly and his pass for the final goal with the outside of his boot was just beautiful, but they managed to win convincingly, playing well, and he didn't score.
Right.
I think that will be a huge relief for them.
I thought you were going to mention Mangala being suspended for this game. But
Well, Sunderland will be buoyed by the fact that Mangala is suspended, and it looks like Vincent Kompany will be out as well. So there'll be a centre-half pairing, presumably, of Martin De Michelis and Dedrick Boyata.
Interesting. Chelsea, meantime, will be playing Spurs without Diogo Costa, who did pick up a yellow card in that game, so he's suspended. Spurs, of course, fresh from not just a win 2-1 against Everton, but what many Spurs fans are calling their finest performance, their most convincing performance under Pochettino, John.
Yeah, they stuck two up front, played a good
crucially,
old 4-4-2.
One of them wasn't Adebayor.
Yeah, not, without Adebayor there. Harry Kane was brilliant again. Yeah, it's a huge confidence boost, and it's the sort of performance that I think Spurs were perhaps... or Spurs fans would have expected to see from a Pochettino side, and they haven't really had it yet. Whether he'll be brave enough to do the same thing on Wednesday evening and play that aggressive two up front remains to be seen.
They're at Stamford Bridge. They haven't won there since, do you know how long?
1990.
Yeah. Wow,
that is there's been several times where it looks like there's been a new dawn for Spurs, and they've only just had it crash when they've had to Stamford Bridge, and you might anticipate the same again, because I think Spurs did play well, but Everton had a massive part of the match yesterday, and also Everton played themselves a very attacking formation away from home, which may have left themselves a little bit more open.
They took the lead, didn't they? A terrific goal from Morales.
A really good goal from Morales.
Yeah. Christian Eriksen also on the score sheet. He has a little bit of the reputation of being one of those players they bought after Bale left, no good. But he's actually scored 11 Premier League goals this calendar
he's
year.
He's probably the best of their buys, isn't he, actually? I mean, certainly more impactful than Lamela for all his Raboniness.
Did you see the story in yesterday's tabloids about Manuel Adebayor having a go at his mum?
No, what did she do?
Well, he has accused her of... casting a spell on him, and that is what is responsible for his goal drought, bad juju. Not a bad attitude, not laziness, just his mother. He said he's not qualified to
remove.
No, that he's not qualified to know whether she's a witch or not.
Ah,
but she apparently and his brothers and sisters claim that he's kicked her out of her house.
Ah,
and she's now selling tomatoes for £1 a day, living in poverty. Adebayor says he hasn't kicked her out of her house, but would like her to stop
casting spells
on him so he can regain form.
Which paper did you read this in, Barry?
Well, it was in one of the tabloids, but it was taken from a radio interview he gave to a radio station in Ghana.
Oh, right.
So it seems to be...
Juju FM.
No, I think it was Peace FM.
Or your daily Juju news.
Yeah. Right. That's quite an extraordinary story.
It would appear to be true, unless it was an imposter.
I can't believe the tomatoes and £1 a day thing going on there. I mean, surely she must have some right as kind of the woman who gave birth to Emmanuel Adebayor.
Yeah, if she's powerful enough to put a hex, a kind of Ian McIntosh-esque hex, surely she could be using her powers for more remunerative.
Well,
yes.
Wasn't it him that when he was a child, he famously tells the story of how he didn't walk till he was about 4 years old.
He's too lazy, or
well, you said that. But apparently his mother brought him to healers and religious folk all over Africa. He used to carry him because he couldn't walk to try and figure out.
It sounds like a great raconteur, this Emmanuel Adebayor.
To try and figure out why he couldn't walk. So this church took them in and said, look, we'll keep him here for a week. If at the end of the week he hasn't taken his first steps, then he never will. So one day he was sitting on a pew or lying on a pew in this church, and he heard kids playing outside, and they were playing football. The ball rolled past him, and he got off the pew and ran to kick it. And that was how he took his first steps.
Wow.
And he scored a goal, and then he slid on his knees in the opposition end and celebrated.
That's just a remarkable story, Barry. Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of part one. We'll have a little breather, and then bang, we're back with the battle for the top four.
The festive season is fast approaching. So this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Hey everyone, it's very tight between 4th place and 9th place in the Premier League. Only 3 points separating all those sides. How many sides? That would be, what, 6 sides would it be? Something like that.
Yeah, if you include 4th.
Yeah. Well, let's include them. Man United, that's who's in 4th place. They've had back-to-back wins, you know. They beat Hull 3-0. They got, Wayne Rooney and Robin van Persie combined for a Premier League goal for the first time since November the 10th, over a year. In over a year. That's interesting, isn't it?
And
yep.
More interesting, Chris Smalling scored the goal and had if not quite a man of the match performance, another very solid game at centre-half.
And people liked Ashley Young. That's another thing.
Yeah, that is another thing. Things appear to be going well.
And yet, it was Hull. Yeah. And also, they looked this good against QPR, didn't they, a month or two ago, and then things went wrong. And also,
Jimbo, you always have to burst the bubble.
No, it's perspective, isn't it? And also, they've had injury number 41 of Van Gaal's reign now, and that's Angel Di Maria. That's not one they're going to shake off lightly.
Yeah, he is a hamstring, so he'll presumably out. I think the silver lining in that cloud is that Ander Herrera played brilliantly when he came on, and it was possible that he might be being shipped out in January.
But Herrera?
I would imagine he'll very much be staying there now on the strength of that performance alone. Mm. Weird thing about this game, it's difficult to know how much to read into it because despite them playing well, Hull were, I'm sure Ian McIntosh, if he was here, would go on about how great they were in defeat again. But Hull were poor. This was Steve Bruce's 700th game as a manager. 21 of those games have been against teams or against Manchester United, and he hasn't won one of those games. And his teams do have a reputation for sort of rolling over when they go to Old Trafford. He took Hatem Ben Arfa off shortly after the half-hour mark because Hull were just getting overrun in midfield, and Ben Arfa, I think, was frustrating him by refusing to track back, refusing to run, basically.
Must have come as a surprise.
Well, he took a punt on him, didn't he? And it's not working out. But, you know, a win is a win, and it was an impressive win. The game was over by half-time. But, yeah, I think Manchester United fans probably shouldn't read too much into it. Interestingly, I would be curious to know, because Chelsea didn't win over the weekend, but when was the last time Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Man City and Spurs all won at the same weekend? It's kind of like a reverting back to the norm, you know, the traditional big six all doing well.
I think there is a little bit of a sense, isn't it, that those that people's squads are beginning to kind of get into shape now, or beginning to gel after all the recruitment over the summer, and perhaps fatigue after the World Cup, that some squads are slightly starting to kick into gear now. And you'll probably get, you know, perhaps your West Hams and your Saints being put under more pressure for their top of the league positions shortly.
It's kind of building up for a really interesting festive period, you know, where it's 1st of December now, we got this midweek block of fixtures, and Christmas is coming, the Boxing Day, New Year's stuff, which should be good.
And then spring afterwards, fantastic.
I love spring.
Yeah, yeah, well, who doesn't?
One thing I thought of during that game is, for the Smalling goal.
Oh, yeah.
Players are still appealing to officials for those "is the ball over the line" kind of moments, when there's no need to anymore. Yeah. It's like appealing for a a kind of inanimate object, isn't it?
Exactly. It's like you're up against robots now. They feel no emotion. They cannot be appealed to.
It's muscle memory, though, isn't
it? Yeah, I guess it must be automatic. Mm. But, yeah.
Tell you what, they don't have that overseas, and there's all sorts of calls for it. You know, there were ghost calls galore around Europe. Well, actually, I can think of one of them. But there was a ghost call, anyway. And, it's a good thing, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They will be hosting Stoke Man United. Hmm. They lost at Liverpool.
Yeah.
They're going to do all right, do you think, Man United? Three wins in a row, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's probably I think there's a couple of fixtures that this midweek that kind of the bigger teams... fixture list has been sort of kind in a way. It's
right.
Like Stoke gives them a really good chance to register another win. And in the same way that I think we were sort of mentioning Southampton earlier, I think going to Arsenal is probably a good place for them to go as well.
Going to Arsenal is a good
place. I just think it's kind of, you know, if you're Southampton and you want to get this monkey of losing against the big sides off your back,
right?
You know, heading down to, they are at the Emirates, aren't they?
Rather they are at the Emirates.
So I think that's kind of. That's where I'd want to go, I think.
Arsenal fans, John's calling your team soft at home. They've only lost two games since the start of last season at home. One was against Aston Villa in the opening day, of course, the previous campaign, and then Man United not so long ago, about 9 days ago. But, hey, here's a stat for you, John. All of Arsenal's Premier League wins this season have come against teams currently 14th or lower in the table. Ooh. But they have got Giroud back. And Welbeck back on the score sheet, and Cazorla looking great. It was a decent win for them, though, wasn't it? Away at West Brom.
I thought West Brom were actually pretty poor. I think when you compared them to Sunderland later in the day. They, you know, both set out with a similar sort of attempt to nullify stronger opposition. But Sunderland at least had an idea what to do with the ball when they got it. West Brom really struggled in that regard. Berahino looked very detached. They were always running into blind alleyways when they did have a chance to counter-attack. And while Lescott, Dawson, etc., and Wisdom all kind of play well, you know, as last line of defence, as opposed to what Barry was saying, they were right on the edge of their box the whole time. They just, it looked like it was going to come, and you know, it was only one goal, but I think there was only ever going to be one winner in that game.
Interestingly, some Arsenal fans unfurled a banner. I don't think it's been the first time it's been shown at the Emirates, but you know, on the back of two successive wins, it seems a bit churlish to unfurl a banner calling for Wenger to go.
Yeah, enough is enough. The banner read the message on the banner.
Well, no, it was quite polite. It was thanks for everything, but sling it,
right.
Basically.
Arsenal didn't miss Wilshire much. Just throw that one out there. And let's move on to West Ham, who are actually above Arsenal in the table. Of course, they're fifth to Arsenal's sixth. Well, they've got a trip to West Brom themselves. So, you know, is it happy days then for the Hammers?
Well, I didn't see their game, but I was talking to Jacob. And
He's writing about their best ever season.
Is he?
Yeah, he says... Well, they had the win against Newcastle, of course, Aaron Cresswell with that. He's saying that this could prove their best ever Premier League season.
Yeah, well, Big Sam said that after the game that it's not his best ever team. He reckons the Bolton team he had with JJ Okocha and all the various sort of semi-galacticals was his best. But he said his current West Ham is next in the line and is getting there, and he expects them to emulate him.
Mm. John, what do you think about West Ham?
Well, all I was going to say is that I think Aaron Cresswell has, you know, you could make a fair case for him being signing of the season so far.
Really?
Well, for less than £4 million, I think it was, they paid Ipswich for him. And he's just been brilliant. I mean, he's settled in and he now looks, you know, one of the best left-backs in the Premier League.
Unless you wanted to say that Sarko, the striker, was one of the best signs of the season.
Yeah.
Or that Stuart Downing was the most rehabilitated player of the season.
Is Sam Allardyce then manager of the season so far?
I'm sure he'd say that.
Yeah.
Well, West Ham in fifth. Very few of us predicted that. Very few. Now, we'll talk more about this Premier League business in a moment, but let's turn our attention now to what happened over in Europe this weekend. All sorts of events going on. Most serious of all, the fan dying in Spain before the Atletico Madrid Deportivo La Coruña game. Sid Lowe joining us now on the line. Sid, terrible news on Sunday. And also, it's not something we hear very much about, fan trouble in Spain. Is this an ongoing problem, or is this a kind of freak occurrence?
I suppose in a way it's sort of a bit of both, and I appreciate that's not a great answer, that there is a sense of clubs having indulged really radical groups of fans for too long and effectively, you know, not being responsible for this, but being perhaps complicit in it to some extent. Fan trouble in general in Spain is not very common, but there have been moments. And for example, the guy that died this weekend, I think is the 11th. I think that's the right number. The 11th fan to die in football related violence since 1982. So obviously, I mean, I honestly don't know how that compares to England, but it's seen for obvious reasons as too much in Spain, and also because I think there's a feeling that what happened this weekend, I wouldn't go so far as to say it was predictable, but there is a sense that a lot of mistakes were made and up to a point it was avoidable. There's also been an awful lot of really quite unpleasant, in my opinion at least anyway, unpleasant attempts to kind of shift the blame and wash their hands of it, in particular from the Atletico Madrid president Enrique Cerezo, whose reaction to it both in tone and content I thought was really quite bad.
Why? What did he say?
Well, essentially, I mean, for those who don't know what happened, and of course we're still picking through the details of this and trying to piece it all together and trying to be clear on what exactly happened. But there was a fight just before 9 o'clock, about 400 meters from the Calderon on Sunday morning. Atletico Madrid were playing Deportivo at midday. It was a fight involving about 200 people. Now, what we're still trying to piece together is what happened in terms of to what extent this was organised by both sets of fans or to what extent it was an ambush. It seems to have been organised by two sets of ultras whose political persuasions are confrontational. So, in other words, a group of far-right fans from the Frente Atlético and a group of far-left fans from a Deportivo fan group known as the Red Thor Blues, which in theory had disbanded when one of its members died in 2003. There's a huge fight, flares going off, people with iron bars and so on, and a fan died when he ended up in the river, and he was in the river for about 30 minutes and essentially died of hypothermia, but also of head injuries. In other words, he'd been clearly quite badly beaten up first. Now, at first, the suggestion was that he may have been thrown in the river. There's since been some footage come out which is difficult to judge properly because you can't see it that clearly, but it seems that he'd kind of climbed over the barrier and to the side of the kind of the walkway where the river is to try and get away from fans. But then you can see in the footage a lot of people, probably 10 or 12, leaning over, and he eventually falls in the water. Now, they're leaning over, presumably trying to push him in or to shout him down or to attack him to make sure he falls in. He's in the water for too long. Obviously, any time is too long, but, I mean, he's in terms of him catching hypothermia, and he died at 2 o'clock. So we're still trying to piece together to what extent it was organised by both sets, and therefore why this was able to happen, in that police had been warned that Atletico Madrid's radical group, the Frente Atlético, had agreed to meet at 8 o'clock for a breakfast meeting. Now a breakfast meeting, obviously, you know, it doesn't entirely convince that a group of fans had travelled down from Galicia for the game, but had travelled, got there early, and headed straight to the river alongside the stadium. A fan from that group has claimed it was an ambush, that this wasn't a set-up fight. It looks like a set-up fight at the moment. And then, of course, there's all sorts of other questions. Why the game wasn't declared high risk in the first place, which means a difference in the number of police and the time they get there and so on. Why the distribution of tickets meant that these fans had tickets to travel. Why it was that no one picked up the Frente Atlético, to what extent this group has been indulged by the club anyway, why it took so long for police and ambulances to get there once it happened, because, as I say, the guy that died was in the water for nearly half an hour. Why the game then went ahead, and you know, there's another bout of quite serious finger-pointing, with the league saying that they phoned the Federation up and there was no one at the Federation, no one answered the phone, so they couldn't cancel the game because it's down to the Federation. Now, sadly, that's all too believable. The Federation spokesman said he found out 2 or 3 minutes before the game, by which time it was too late. But it seems to me, surely a unilateral decision can still be made by the league, which, by the way, has ridden completely roughshod over lots of other things the Federation have tried to tell them to do, and they've said, no, we're going to do it our way. And those two are at war at the moment, so I think there's a convenience in blaming each other. And then to get to Cerezo, sorry, I realise I've gone round to get to him. After the game, Cerezo came out and said, this is nothing to do with football. It happened a long way from the stadium. It's nothing to do with us. And While I can understand a club trying to say this is, you know, this is about something bigger than football, to completely wash their hands of responsibility when these are people who define themselves, amongst other things, by their far-right political agenda, but also by their support of Atletico Madrid, people who travel to Atletico Madrid games, who've been lauded by the club at other times, who now we don't yet know, but people are now investigating to where do they get their tickets from, how many tickets do they get, how much has been done to try and prevent the kind of trouble that's happened with these fans before, who, by the way, killed a Real Sociedad fan back in 16 years ago. And then it wasn't just that, but Cerezo spoke, then the president of Deportivo La Coruña spoke, who spoke, by the way, much, much better in terms of tone and content, and I thought judged the moment much, much better. Then the vice president of the league spoke, and as they got up to leave, Cerezo leant into the microphone again and said, make sure you treat this the right way for what this really is. And everyone's looking at it and thinking, even if you had a point, the way in which it was done, I personally thought was really quite grotesque.
Mm. All right, Sip. OK, well, in other news, Real Madrid won their 16th straight game, which is a record for them. Barcelona won at Valencia. Messi got hit by a bottle. Is that right?
Yeah, in the celebration of the goal. I mean, of all the days as well for something like that to happen.
Mm.
And Barcelona struggled a little bit, and in fact struggled quite a lot. They got the goal in the 93rd minute, I think it was. Sergio Busquets scored it, and when they were jumping on top of each other celebrating, and bottle came down and hit Messi on the head. Messi was booked for it because he was complaining to the referee, and he picked the bottle up and he showed him, and then threw the bottle back down. According to the official referee's report, Messi was booked for time wasting. I think he was booked for trying to point out that he'd been hit by a bottle.
All right. And David Moyes had his home debut at the Anoeta.
A
3-0 win against Elche. A hat-trick from Carlos Vela, or Stefano Vela, as he perhaps calls him.
No, well, Stefano, I think was aimed at Esteban Granero.
All right.
That was a kind of a tongue twister between Esteban plus Granero plus foreign language plus being new plus, you know, tension of the game equals Stefano. Carlos Vela played really, really well. Real Sociedad, I think, look improved in terms of the intensity they're playing with. I think they look a little bit more aggressive. But that may well be, as players have often said before, just a consequence of a new manager, any new manager.
Hmm.
Bit by bit, I think Moyes will start getting what he wants from the team. I think in terms of the quality of the players, they really should be much higher in the league anyway. And
Sid, many thanks for that. Excellent stuff. We'll speak up. We'll speak with you soon.
Okie dokie, speak to them.
Sidlo in Spain. Germany mentioned briefly back at the start, the Dortmund continue their terrible run. They're in last place, all on their own now. And they had another defeat this weekend, 2-0 to Frankfurt. But I guess the significant thing here, everyone's been waiting for the tide to turn on this one and this kind of blip to resolve itself. But now the club are really seriously talking about a relegation battle. And the fans who've been steadfast in their support of the team and of Klopp are actually beginning to boo and jeer the manager, who's talking about making way if the club can find somewhere better. So it's extraordinary the speed at which that whole kind of fairy tale business is unravelling there in the Ruhr. In Italy, fantastic derby game between Juve and Torino. Did you saw this at all, did you? Torino hadn't had picked up a point in the derby since 2008. They hadn't scored a goal in the derby since 2002. And after Vidal opened the scoring, looked like it was going to be the same old story. But then Bruno Perez goes on an extraordinary run from his own area, passes the entire Juve team on the way, and then lashes home an equaliser. And 1-1 it stayed till the 93rd minute, when, on the last kick of the game, Andrea Pirlo, pow, threaded one through, and Juve took the points as usual. I mentioned the Maldinis. Roma had a big 4-2 win against Inter to stay in touch at the top, but Maldini, the Paolo Maldini's sons, both scored on, I think it was Saturday.
He's two sons, is he?
Yeah, he has two. Christian, who's now 18 and was making his debut for the Primavera, which is like the junior team, and you know, by that this point he could well be in line for a senior team appearance. But anyway, he scored, but then he had to go off with a muscle problem after half an hour or so. But also Daniel, the younger one. Daniel was the one who, you've seen the YouTube clip, yeah, of a young Maldini tackling Clarence Seedorf. That was Daniel. Albert Riera, you've probably seen this story.
Mm.
No longer at Udinese after nil appearances. He's had his contract rescinded after tweeting that they were the worst club he'd ever played for, or basically not played for, and B, not turning up to a game and going to a casino in Slovenia instead, where he won some money. So that's nice. Lots of people tweeting about the FA Trophy goal from Worcester City's Sean Geddes. Sean Geddin, I would I would say. Have you seen this?
No.
It's Rabona-tastic.
Oh.
Yeah. But you basically, if you Google that, or maybe guest producer Pete is with us today, we'll put a little link. I don't know. Anyway, have a bit of a musical sting, and then we'll be back on that Premier League ting.
Discover how to play football like a pro with some help from The Secret Footballer's must-read new book. From tactics to fitness, pitch lingo to finances, The Guardian's man on the inside will tell you everything you need to know. And because you're a Football Weekly listener, you can save more than 40% on the all-new Secret Footballer's Guide to the Modern Game with our exclusive offer. Head to theguardian.com/bookshop and enter the code FOOTBALLER and you'll get the book for just £7.49, saving over £5. Go to theguardian.com/bookshop and enter the code FOOTBALLER.
Battle at the bottom. That's what it is. It's a battle there, John. And it features Burnley. But maybe not for too much longer, Burnley, eh? They're unbeaten. Is it unbeaten in three now? Maybe more. They had two wins. Then they drew at the weekend. And now they're taking on Newcastle. Newcastle without Sissoko, because, of course, he went and got himself booked in that defeat they had away at West Ham.
Jack Colback is out too. He's suspended.
He's suspended as well,
is
he?
It'd be a big loss. He's been playing very well for them during their run of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, do you think they're going to have a run of misery now? Because you've got this Burnley game, away at tough turf moor. And then you've got, after that, you like to look forward, don't you, Barry? And look at the games they've got coming up, Newcastle. They've got Chelsea, Arsenal and Man United.
Yeah, it's a tough run.
It's a tough run.
But that's so unpredictable now that, you know, it'd take a brave man to predict good or bad things.
We're fresh out of those in this pod. right, OK, anyway, Burnley taking on Newcastle. Care to venture an opinion on that?
I think when Newcastle have had their backs to the wall, they've produced stronger performances, and there is an imperative for them to get something now before they go into that run.
That's true.
I would say I might back an away win there.
Would you? All right.
Yes, despite the upturn in fortunes for Burnley.
Danny Ings has scored 5 goals in his last 5 starts for club and country.
Yeah, there was some talk in one of the tabloids today about Southampton possibly making a move for him in January. He used to play for them as a junior.
Did he?
Back in his teens, I think, before he went to Bournemouth. I'm really pleased that Burnley have improved, and I think it's great that for Sean Dyche, who's a nice guy and a good manager, and was beginning to get under a little bit of pressure, I think, even though he'd overachieved with the team last year. And I think it's good that they've, you know, although he was under a bit of pressure, there was no sense of it sort of snowballing, and they've stuck with him, and yeah, hopefully they're getting a few rewards now.
Right,
they've still got a long way to go to, you know, give themselves a chance of staying up, but you know.
Absolutely.
Off the field, obviously, being Newcastle, they have to have a little off the field. But they sorry for rustling, producer Pete. Off the field, they've had another row with the Telegraph, who they've already banned from St James's Park back in September, because Luke Edwards, who, in my opinion, is a fine writer and he's very well respected among his peers, said that Ashley was prepared to listen to offers for the club. And now Luke has published an article last week in which he outlined why Rangers and Newcastle will not be able to play in Europe at the same time, should they both qualify, because Mike Ashley has an influence in both clubs, and there are UEFA rules which suggest that, this is the case. But Newcastle then posted a message on their website in which they accused him and the Telegraph of lying.
Right. Strong stuff. If we're talking about managers under pressure, how about Nigel Pearson at Leicester? Are they bottom? Yep, they're bottom. And they did get a goal this weekend. But still, it's December the 1st and we haven't had a manager sacked yet, John. So, come on, Premier League.
Could it be Nigel? Yeah.
Yeah, could it be? I don't know. You've got Tony Pulis hovering around like a baseball capped something.
So you
Messer
think
of your choice.
Leicester's sort of boardroom are making plans for Nigel?
Hey! We shouldn't be chuckling. No. Yeah, well, let's hope not from his point of view.
They were unfortunate, I think, at the weekend. They had a fair, it was a ding dong battle at Loftus Road, and they had they took the lead early. They had chances to go 2-1 up themselves, and a couple of good saves made by the line of Rustenburg. But it was generally quite a low quality match in general, and you can see why they're both struggling at the bottom.
Low quality, but very exciting.
Yeah,
very
like
entertaining.
The Premier League.
I mean, I think it would be incredibly harsh if Nigel Pearson lost his job. But again, you get compensated and he will get another job. So it's not sort of the tragedy it could be. But yeah, I think people will trigger happy chairman may look at what Tony Pulis did with Crystal Palace last season. Like, he really, it was a Lazarus job. And that it can be done and he's available, so why not?
Right.
Part of the worrying thing for Leicester as well is that they were so much better than QPR and Burnley, for that matter, last season. And those teams have seemed to have kicked on and caught up and perhaps even overtaken them. So
fine. They've got a big game coming up midweek. They are at home to Liverpool, a Liverpool side fresh from their first win in six. That was against Stoke. On the agenda, praise for Mignolet.
Well, he kept a clean sheet. It was confidence boosting. I think he had one flap at a corner towards the end, but that corner came about as a result of a fine save he made. I'd say it'd be a huge relief for him to keep a clean sheet after his recent blunders, and it's just a huge relief for Liverpool in general to keep a clean sheet.
Right.
And so it's, you know, I wouldn't get too excited about it, but Stoke's record at Anfield as well is atrocious. But I think they haven't won there since the mid 80s.
Brendan Rodgers has scaled back his tactical philosophy for this.
Yeah, that's right.
Told Mignolet just to hoof it and not try any of that dinky pass.
Yeah, and also, you know, putting Lucas in the centre of midfield and Lambert up front, it's just a slightly less expansive, a bit more basic formation, but one that people can actually perform to.
Having said all of that, it was only that brave header from Glenn Johnson that actually won them the points in this game. Could easily have been another disappointing Liverpool performance.
Well, the second half they played well. The first half was disappointing, but the second half they played well. But yeah, it was soon to be out of contract Glenn Johnson who made that ball his.
He certainly did.
And Steven Gerrard was on the bench, of course, which was a big talking point. Was he being rested or was he being dropped? There's talk today that he has been offered a new contract, but some suggest it's on greatly reduced wages, and there's no indication that whether it's 1 year or 2 years.
All right. More on that Gerrard contract news when we know. More Liverpool fans, though, would like the club to save some money and perhaps give them cheaper tickets as a result. The banner there mentioning the increase in ticket prices over the last 20, 30 years. Banner there protesting against over 1,000% inflation in ticket prices since 1990. It was kind of timely, this, after it was revealed that the Premier League had spent £115 million on agents' fees over the transfer window.
Exactly. It's absolutely ridiculous. You know, once again, another massive TV deal. And where does any of that money end up for the fans? Nowhere. You know? There's nothing. The fans are being taken for granted, being treated like mugs in every single club in the country. Well,
market forces, Paul.
Well, it's market forces. Do we necessarily have to subscribe to market forces? They don't do it in American sport, et cetera, and so on. It doesn't have to be that way. It's a very, you know, it's a very handy thing to fall back on when Scudamore's talking about you being the biggest, you know, brand in the world. But what does that matter to British fans?
Well,
who actually pay to go and watch the game?
And contribute a lot to the fact that it is one of the biggest brands in the world. Well, because if they weren't there, it would look pretty pathetic.
And I have to kind of, you know, the idea that we're getting more libraries, etc. We've had this conversation before, but there is a link between expensive match day tickets and people not necessarily giving their, you know, fulsome support to the, or vocal support to the team.
Increasingly, I mean, it used to be, you know, if you had a sort of half empty stadium and there's, you know, there are, everybody knows the chants about, you know, people selling tickets and empty seats and things. But increasingly, I think people are less inclined to take the mickey out of opposition teams for having half-empty stadiums because everybody knows how much it costs these days. And I think you can't criticise fans anymore for not going to football matches because it's just so ridiculously expensive.
Yeah. Yep. QPR are going to meet at Swansea at the Liberty Stadium, which is usually home of a rocking atmosphere. Oh, QPR have lost every away game this season. Swansea hosted Crystal Palace there at the weekend. Surprisingly, we're held to a 1-1 draw. I was surprised by that.
There has been this thing with Swansea not being able to see out games. Obviously, the penalty they conceded was in the first half, I think, but they did take the lead and they were the better side, but they didn't close out the game.
Wilfred Bony.
They've dropped 13 points from winning positions this season. Yeah. Which is a lot of points.
Yeah, they're still eighth, and you know, some 8 points clear of the relegation zone. So I don't think it's panic stations for Swansea at all, and they've got a strong squad.
Right, Wilfred Bony has scored more goals than any other player in the Premier League in this calendar year.
Yeah,
how about that?
Also, Leroy Fair, read here, made more battles, contested more battles for the ball, more duels, and had more successes than any other player in the Premier League. So a bit of bite away from home, it would not be a bad thing for QPR.
It's been a good weekend for former Norwich players. No?
It's certainly better than for actual Norwich players.
Ricky Van Wolfsfingel scoring in his second straight game.
My word.
France.
That makes it four for the season, does it?
Maybe
three.
Maybe three. I'm not entirely sure. What happened to Norwich, Simple?
We got turned over at home by Reading. What I was banging on about fans and their experience is partly informed by my own experience, where tickets are expensive. Mm. We sell out basically most games, but the atmosphere in our ground at the minute is absolutely poisonous.
Right.
They got booed at half time and extensively booed at. I mean, the booing just went, even on the official club YouTube highlights, it fades out with 30 seconds of booing because there's nothing else to put on there. And people, you know, people are like, we want better. Because we are paying a lot of money and we expect to have a good team. Now, I'm not sure those two things link up, but people are getting very upset that the atmosphere there, people were rowing with John Ruddy, rowing with the chief executive.
Mm.
It's not good.
The people getting angry. Are you suggesting we're reaching some sort of tipping point in terms of unhappiness with ticket sales?
Or people be a Norfolk peasants' revolt.
Well, I just think it happens everywhere. Mm. You know, it happened at West Ham last season. It happens. People quite quickly will turn on their club if things aren't going well. And I think part of the reason for that is because they're paying a lot of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, Palace. Milic had scored 5 goals in his last 8 Premier League appearances after netting just once in his first 32 in all competitions. How interesting. Palace are going to be hosting Aston Villa. Ooh, speaking of people scoring, Joe Cole.
Joe Cole, Chris Smalling and Glenn Johnson all scoring in the same weekend.
And Soldado. We haven't got on there yet. Yeah. How do you fancy their chances then away at Crystal Palace, Villa?
The statistics and history would suggest they have very little chance. They lost this fixture twice, 1-0 last season, home and away. Their record at Selhurst Park is dire. Lost 5 and drawn 6 in their last 11 visits. They're averaging a goal every 3 games.
Right.
And, this is a good stat, I think, Villa's substitutes have yet to chip in with a goal or an assist in the Premier League this season.
Is that so?
Yeah.
But you forget that they're playing with a smile on their face now and a spring in their step.
Yeah. And apparently they did play with a smile on their face and a spring in their step.
So this is all following the departure of Roy Keane. Roy Keane. I'm sure
the two are in no way linked whatsoever.
Right.
It's probably a lot easier to play football when you don't have him sitting on the sideline glaring at you.
Mm.
I would imagine it instills a certain amount of fear. And even if you're playing quite well, you're probably not playing as well as he would or he thinks you should be playing. So you can kind of understand why the handbrake might have come off.
Yeah. It says here on the table, they've only scored 7 goals this season, Villa.
Villa? Was it that many? Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to say, you do wonder if this podcast would be so full of humour and analysis and clever comment if Roy Keane was sat in the corner of the room staring at us.
Certainly wouldn't be full of comment about Roy Keane.
Some of us would thrive under that pressure, John.
Maybe. I think mine might be cowed.
Wow. That's quite a thought, isn't it? Quite a thought. Producer Pete, there's in no way an inference that you carry less respect with us.
Or indeed that you hire Roy Keane as an assistant producer.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Let's finish off then on Everton, who are taking on Hull after their defeat against Spurs. We talked a bit about Spurs' performance. You felt Everton looked like they could have had something from that. What about this game against Hull? And similar line to that business with poor old Nigel Pearson at Leicester. Hull, now only goal difference keeping them out the bottom three. We mentioned the similar slumps that Steve Bruce has had in the past, and with Sunderland, and whether something similar is happening with the Tigers.
It happened. Am I right in thinking it happened with Wigan as well?
I think it did, didn't it?
Yeah, and then there's also the periods of clubs where you just walked out on when they weren't doing particularly well. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do for a club when you come up and you stay up to make that transition from plucky newly promoted side into established Premier League side, and that's what he's tried to do by buying all these names. But they haven't. They have unbalanced the side.
I was reading the Hull Daily Mail this morning, as you do, and they suggest the solution to his problems is an Irish solution.
Oh,
they think David Myler and Stephen Quinn should start in midfield and sort of add a bit of muscle, and because apparently they were just completely overrun against Manchester United.
Daily Mail calling for immigrants to take English jobs. That's remarkable.
It's the Hull Daily Mail.
Oh, yeah, right, okay. Everton at home to Hull? Yeah, I mean,
home win, I think.
I would go for a home win, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that's it for this edition of Football Weekly Extra. Returns on Thursday with our reactions to those games and, yikes, our previews of another round of action that's going to be following hard on its heels. In the meantime, many thanks to guest producer Pete, to John Ashdown, Paul McInnes and Barry Glendenning. John and Barry, you'll be back with us on Wednesday evening, though, when we will be enjoying Arsenal-Southampton in the company of 800 close personal friends. That's Football Weekly Live in London, which has been sold out, of course, pretty much since we first thought of it. But there have been one or two people, only a few, who have been gutted to find that they can't actually make it and have tickets up for grabs on Twitter. Probably if you have one of those, you put hashtag gutted but can't make it, Football Weekly Live, something like that. People will find it. Anyway, we're talking in the low hundreds. Very few. Anyway, super. If you're coming along on Wednesday, we'll see you then. Otherwise, back here on Thursday for another edition of Football Weekly. Bye for now.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.